You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I was joined by Dr. Ed Packer from the Basque Children Association. We discussed the story of the 4,000 children that were brought to Britain in 1937. These children came to Britain at a time when their homes and their families were in serious danger, and their story is a mixture of fascinating and also a little heartbreaking. If you want to learn more about these children, you can go to basquechildren.org, which I've included a link to in the show notes and on the podcast website. It's a really cool site with a lot of really fascinating information about the experiences of these children, both during the Spanish Civil War, their time in Britain, and then also afterwards. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Ed Packard, a trustee for the Basque Children Association. The association was started in 2002 with the goals of remembrance and education about the 4,000 children who came to Britain from Spain in 1937. Dr. Packard, how's it going today?
It's going quite well, as well as could be expected in 2020. As a historian based in Britain, we're facing up to another lockdown from Thursday. But other than that, it's good that at least the sun's shining today.
Excellent. Good to hear. Okay, so here we are here today to talk about the Basque children. Now, these were Spanish children evacuated from Spain, and it seems like many of them were very young. What were the age ranges of the children that we're talking about today?
Essentially, it's children between the age of 5 and 15. 4,000 boys and girls between the age of 5 and 15. Now, the campaign to bring the Basque children to Britain began in the aftermath of the Guernica bombing on the 26th of April, 1937. And a couple of days after that, owing to public pressure, the government agreed to allow some children in. By the 15th of May, that had become a firm commitment to allow 2,000 children in. Between 6 and 12. And then a couple of days later, partly because one of the organisations that was pressing for the children to be allowed in was really concerned. It's quite a racist concern in some ways. They were concerned about what would happen to older girls if the city of Bilbao fell to the rebels, General Franco's rebel troops, who were predominantly from Morocco. And they worried what would happen to the older girls. If that was the case. And so on the 17th and 18th of May, the government said they'd allow 4,000 children in. So they doubled the amount and they would be aged between 5 and 15. So they went from between 6 and 12 to 5 and 15, although most of them were somewhere in the middle. There were very few at the two extremes. Now, it's worth also pointing out that the ship that brought the children to Britain sailed on the 21st of May from the port of Santurce near Bilbao. And so this was quite a rapidly changing set of circumstances. So Guernica is the 26th of April. The children arrive in Britain less than a month later. And the people organising, both in Bilbao and in Southampton, where they arrived, they initially thought they were going to get 2,000, and then less than a week before they arrive, it's going to be 4,000.
I bet there was a bit of scrambling to make that work.
There was. Where the children first were taken to was a place called North Stoneham, which is just outside Southampton, and a farmer had offered his field, you know, a large field for the children to stay in, and it was essentially a campsite. There were 500 tents for 4,000 children, to be honest, you know, conditions got pretty unsanitary there quite quickly. It was only meant to be a temporary accommodation. I suppose as well, while we're thinking of numbers, 4,000 sounds like a lot of children. And if you look up photos of the children arriving, they arrived on an old liner called the SS Havana, which was not designed for 4,000 people. And if you see video footage or still photographs of this ship arriving into Southampton, it looks absolutely crammed. And it does look like an enormous amount of children. The main historian of the Basque children, a man called Adrian Bell, he's written that this was the largest single influx of refugees into Britain, and they were pretty much all children. They were accompanied by some adults. They weren't accompanied by their parents. That wasn't allowed. Much like the kinder transport the following year, which began the following year. But it's worth putting this into some kind of context, because in the Spanish Civil War there were over 500,000 people who left Spain, in many cases permanently to various countries in Europe, and just amongst the Basque children in 1937, there's around 20,000 children who leave, and most go to France. France takes the vast majority. 4,000 come to Britain, others go to Belgium, Denmark, Mexico, the Soviet Union, and Switzerland. So I think it's worth putting that into context too.
Excellent. So these children, they come to Britain, and the government allowed them. Obviously, they had to have government permission to get into the country. But my understanding is that this was not a government-funded program or government-funded project. So how was support raised to kind of fund these children coming and supporting them, and how was the effort coordinated?
Well, I think there's a few sides to that. I think it's first of all worth concentrating a little bit on why the government's attitude, why the government weren't sponsoring this program, and in fact the government quite hostile to the idea. And that needs to be put into context as to Britain's policy towards the Spanish Civil War, which, as I'm sure you've discussed on other podcasts, it was in line with appeasement. It was a policy of non-intervention. The idea for the British government was, if the other powers of Europe didn't supply the Spanish Civil War or didn't choose a side in the Spanish Civil War, the conflict would die out through lack of supplies and such like. And then Britain didn't want the situation in Spain to escalate to a general war. But when the Spanish Civil War broke out in July 36, the Basque country was loyal to the Republic. If you look at a map of the Spanish Civil War when the Civil War breaks out, the vast majority of Republican territories in the south and the east, but there's a strip of territory in the north, which is kind of separated by the rebel territory, which includes a large amount of the Basque country, including the industrial centre of Bilbao, quite important for a war effort. The Basque country's loyalty is interesting because the Basque Nationalist Party, which was quite important in the Basque country, remained loyal to the Republic, even though it was quite a socially conservative group, because ultimately Franco didn't want to allow any kind of regional autonomy to any part of Spain. So the Basques, with their history, weren't going to get behind that. So in March 1937, Franco's forces invade the north, and they do this with two classic kind of weapons of total war: a blockade by the navy to try and starve the population, and bombing by German and Italian aircraft, most famously Guernica. So Guernica, the bombing of this market town, which was reported on in the Times. The journalist George Steer wrote a famous article outlining what had happened in Guernica, and obviously to British public opinion, knowing what was going to come in the next war, already kind of knowing that the next war would involve kind of bombing of cities. This caused a widespread outrage. And also these bombings and the blockade exacerbate an internal refugee crisis. So Bilbao is getting full of people, full of hungry people who are also being bombed. Bilbao is bombed regularly as well. So this is where the kind of the effort to kind of bring the Basque children to Britain begins. A lady called Leah Manning, who was a former MP for the Labour Party, arrived in Bilbao just before Guernica, and she was trying to arrange an evacuation of children through her her then role as a representative of the National Joint Committee for Spanish Relief, which was a non-governmental organisation which had sprung up in the towards the end of 1936, because in response to the Spanish Civil War, lots of British people, lots of groups in Britain wanted to do something to help the Republic, or the other side, or the rebels to a lesser extent. A lot of groups had sprung up to try and offer aid to particularly civilians who were suffering as a result. And a lot of these were kind of grassroots and disorganized. So the National Joint Committee was a kind of umbrella for a lot of these groups. And so Leah Manning's in Bilbao. She starts sending, particularly after Guernica, these urgent telegrams back to London. The British consul in Bilbao, Michael Ralph Stevenson, is also advocating for an evacuation of children as well. And the National Joint Committee is campaigning in Britain. And this is what forces the British government to kind of accept, in principle, the admission of some children. And so the government accepts the children, but it doesn't approve of them. A number of figures in the government, a number of figures in the civil service, including the Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, express misgivings. Franco and his supporters in Spain and Britain also were highly opposed. And the government was concerned to maintain the non-intervention pact. The British ambassador to Spain, a man called Sir Henry Chilton, he argued that if you took children away from Bilbao and took them and let them go into Britain, you would be undermining non-intervention, because you'd be removing what he called useless mouths. In other words, the Republican side had to feed these children. If you took them out of the war zone, you could feed your soldiers instead, and it would be and that would not be in keeping with non-intervention. So kind of horrific kind of view,
it's
really.
It's not very pleasant at all.
No, but the government had to relent because of the public outcry. It's a very rare example of where kind of public opinion forces a change of policy. But the government, as you say, they don't sponsor this program. They allow the children in, but they have very strict instructions. So to kind of maintain the facade of non-intervention, they say the children should be selected from all creeds and classes without distinction of political attachment. So in theory, the idea was that you should take a certain number of children from each of the main kind of political groups in the Basque Country, if their parents identified as such. In practice, it was quite easy to get around that. And it was particularly kind of socialist parents who were eager to get their children out of the Basque Country at that point. The other condition was that these children should be repatriated as soon as conditions permitted, and that became controversial later on. And the other condition was that the National Joint Committee would have complete responsibility, financially and otherwise, for the children. In other words, the National Joint Committee for Spanish Relief would not just be responsible for raising money to look after the children, but would be responsible for organising the accommodation, education, and everything else that comes with looking after 4,000 children aged between 5 and 15. The government specified that by allowing these children in, the National Joint Committee was committing to raising 10 shillings per child per week. And 10 shillings in 1937 would have been roughly £25 today, or around $30 today. Although I'm aware by the time the podcast goes out, the pound-dollar exchange rate might be in turmoil, but who knows. In any case, the effort was coordinated not by the National Joint Committee, because once it became clear the children were coming, official representatives of the labour movement in Britain and the Catholic Church in Britain said, we want to get involved, we want to help look after these children. But they refused to cooperate directly with the National Joint Committee, because the National Joint Committee was willing to work with communists. So kind of the wider politics of this wider European civil war come into play at this point as well. So on the 15th of May, and again, think about how quickly this is all happening. The 15th of May, the children arrive in just over a week. 15th of May 1937, a Basque Children's Committee is formed, which enables the participation of the church, the Catholic Church, and the Trades Union Congress. The NJC, the National Joint Committee, do wield a strong influence over the new committee. Its members are in important positions within the Basque Children's Committee. But nonetheless, the Basque Children's Committee is designed to be this very broad, overarching humanitarian organisation, trying to avoid political divisions. But by the time the Basque Children's Committee had been formed, there was already a national fundraising campaign underway. This began in earnest at the start of May 1937, so a week or so after Guernica, a few days after the government have said we'll allow some children in. A letter appears in the Times newspaper. It's an avowedly non-partisan, it's a humanitarian letter, which is asking for donations. And people from a range of political backgrounds sign this letter, including Catherine Stuart Murray, the Duchess of Athol, who was a Conservative MP who chaired both the National Joint Committee and the Basque Children's Committee. So there are, you know, at first there's this very wide ranging, cutting across political and religious divisions, a very kind of humanitarian appeal, which was reinforced by media reports both before and after the Havana arrives at Southampton carrying the children. The campaign to support the children very much avoids discussing any rights or wrongs about the Civil War. It portrays the children as stricken waifs. The idea is that these children are innocent, apolitical victims of a modern conflict. And of course, children were a major source of humanitarian concern in Britain throughout the Spanish Civil War. The Duchess of Athol and Eleanor Rathbone, an independent MP, had visited Madrid in April 1937 and been horrified by the plight of children there. People might be familiar with the if you tolerate this poster, which shows a child victim of the battle for Madrid. So, you know, children and humanitarianism kind of go hand in hand with the Spanish Civil War and British reactions to it. The campaign meets with enormous amounts of success. By the end of May 1937, the Basque Children's Committee's secretary, a man called Wilfred Roberts, who was a Liberal MP and another leading light in the National Joint Committee, he estimated that they'd raised about £22,000, enormous sum of money. It wasn't just money that was coming in as well. There were lots of offers for accommodation and other things that children need, clothing, toys, things like that. The Catholic Church and the Salvation Army respectively agreed to house 1,200 and 400 children without charge. And the Basque Children's Committee received 252 offers of free accommodation for the remainder in what were called approved local centres. We'll talk about where the children are sent to later on, I'm sure. But just to say that they don't end up going to 252 different places, but it's just a kind of a sign of a scale that they receive these offers for accommodation. Much of this organisation and fundraising was centrally coordinated at first by the Basque Children's Committee, but over the weeks and months, lots of local groups sprang up who would take responsibility for fundraising and caring for groups of the children. And although we'll presumably go over the story of the children's stay in Britain, as the children's stay in Britain did turn from months to years, there was an element of charity fatigue. People in Britain started to get more concerned by other things as well as 37 turned to 38 to 39.
There are
other things. And I think both the parents of the children who were sent over to Britain and people who were offering to help look after them didn't anticipate they would be here for very long. The main trope that surrounds this is the idea that a lot of the children remember being told they were only going away for 3 months, which is the title of Adrian Bell's History of the Basque Children, which is well worth reading. But most of them were still here after 3 months. The vast majority were still here. Over half were still in Britain a year later. And of course, as the children turn up, they start to challenge this idea that they are these apolitical, stricken waifs, the idea that children have totally no agency at all. Of course, they challenge that. A lot of them have had quite significant political experiences, as part of their upbringing during the Spanish Second Republic. There are controversies connected to the children, especially over the question of their repatriation, and it was impossible to sustain this initial broad-based humanitarian enthusiasm for them. As time goes on, the children were able to contribute a little to their own upkeep as funds tighten. Some of the children in some of the places they're sent to dress up in national costume. They make their own kind of costumes. They do songs and dances to audiences across the regions in which they're staying, and they prove quite lucrative. So there is some sense of the children being able to contribute to their own upkeep, which gave them a degree of agency and reduced their sense of helplessness.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
So you mentioned that when they get to Britain, they end up in a field with tents, but yes. That's not how, hopefully they were moved out of there as quickly as possible. So what was the living conditions for these children? I assume it varied a lot from place to place, but what was it, what was life like in Britain for what turned into years?
Yeah, absolutely. There would have been 4,000 totally different experiences. And of course, many of those experiences have been lost. Thankfully, partly through the work of the Basque Children's Association that you mentioned at the beginning, we've been able to capture more of these stories from the children in their older ages. But they were dispersed from North Stoneham. Between May and September 1937, they were sent to locations across the country. So some children ended up staying in that field for from May through to September. You know, as I say, conditions at the beginning were pretty chaotic in North Stoneham. Things did you know, as with anything, kind of the adults in charge started to learn how to do this. For a lot of people, this was the first time anything like this had happened, or they've been involved in anything like this. So they had to kind of sometimes make it up as they went along. But order was gradually installed at North Stoneham. They were quite eager to get the children out of there. So they were dispersed to locations across the country. As I said, the Salvation Army took 400, the Catholic Church took 1,200. Most of the remainder went to what were called colonies, which were set up on the initiative of local individuals and groups. So I live in a town called Ipswich. In Ipswich, a group was formed, which took 100 children. 100 children came here in June 1937. And these local groups tended to take on the burden of fundraising locally and looking after the children locally, which took some pressure off the Basque Children's Committee. We don't know exactly how many colonies existed. That's still debated. Lots of kind of local history groups kind of do research into the Basque children and help us kind of get a sense of the different places they went to. But approximately 70 to 90 colonies existed at various times and places across England, Scotland and Wales. Some were very short-lived, some lasted for a few years. children could and did move between colonies. So that, you know, they're quite impermanent, transient places. So for example, the children who come to Ipswich, they stay in a Georgian mansion house for the first after the first 8 or 9 months of their stay here, and then they move to an old disused workhouse 10 miles outside of Ipswich for the next part of their stay. So the same colony stays in different places, and very different experiences from a beautiful kind of mansion house to a rat infested old workhouse. But at least it was a roof over their heads. So there was a huge variety of experiences. I mentioned that the children got into controversy, and some of that was related to the poorer experiences that they had. So some groups which were sent to Breckford in Wales or Harwood Dale near Scarborough, they had very poor accommodation, very poor food. Food was often kind of the crucial factor in whether a colony succeeded or not. And this caused some kind of local unrest. Stories of Basque children roaming the local area with knives or throwing stones were reported in the newspapers, and led to scandal. Other colonies were much happier. The colony at Ipswich was like a boarding school, for example. So the children kind of had their rooms, they had their lessons on site, and the food was pretty good. I think Adrian Bell, who I keep mentioning, who's the kind of the main historian of the children, he called this a lottery of dispersal, and some children were decidedly luckier than others. So the children who went to Cambridge, for example, were greeted by several hundred people welcoming them at the railway station, which is quite touching. Same with the children who came to Ipswich, they were greeted by a crowd at the railway station. But, you know, there were sometimes more problematic relationships with local communities. In Margate, this is often kind of described as the horror story of the colony experience. Margate, which is a seaside town in Kent, the children often went cold and hungry in a disused and dilapidated schoolhouse. There wasn't much order in the colony. The people in charge didn't implement much sense of purpose. There's a lot of bullying and not enough staff. So, you know, that was problematic. And the BCC sometimes had to step in to deal with problems, but at the same time, the BCC couldn't afford to be choosy at times. It had to kind of take what it could get sometimes, particularly later on. There's a diverse experience there. In East Anglia, where I live, as I said, the Cambridge colony was very successful. The Ipswich colony was very successful, at least at first. Just down the road from me, a place called Langham, which is between Ipswich and Colchester, there was a colony in the countryside, which was run by the Peace Pledge Union. They agreed to take 60 children into this country mansion at Langham. It was financed entirely by Peace Pledge Union members and its sympathisers making donations. That colony was, by all accounts, wonderful. The education was superb. The children wrote and published their own magazine, of which copies survive, so we get a sense of the children's voice. I would say beneath the kind of camaraderie which was often engendered in the successful colonies, the children were often, they will often say in their memories that they had a happy time in particular colonies, but even those who were happy, of course, they could never escape the memory of what was going on in Spain. They often thought about their parents, you know, the era before, we say in 2020 with families sometimes struggle to kind of keep in touch, but of course we've got things like Zoom and FaceTime, etc. You know, in 1937, these children very rarely heard from their parents, if at all, and this was a source of great concern. One child whose memories I have from the Ipswich colony, she remembers being very happy with life, life in Suffolk, in Ipswich, but she does remember also crying herself to sleep sometimes because she thought about her parents. So you know, that was always there in the back of their mind.
As they lived in Britain for these years, months and then years, was there growing government pressure to start sending them back even before maybe the Civil War was over?
Yeah, absolutely. And this was the major controversy the children got themselves into, which again, things happen quite quickly, because the turning point is the 19th of June, 1937. So again, just going back through the dates, 26th of April, Guernica, 23rd of May, the children arrive in Britain, 19th of May, Bilbao falls to the rebel forces. This is announced at North Stoneham over the loudspeakers there, and it causes absolute mayhem. The children burst into tears, they're wailing, some run into the woods, and it takes a while to kind of gather them back. Some of the older boys march down to Southampton waterfront and say they're going to get on a boat and go and help their fathers. This is a real kind of source of sadness and anxiety for the children. But of course, with victory over the Basque country, with the fall of Bilbao, Franco and the Francoist authorities say the children come back now. Conditions permit their repatriation. The Basque country is not a war zone anymore. And so less than a month after the children arrive here, this question of repatriation fragments the broad-based humanitarian cooperation, which had up to this point marked the Basque Children's Committee. Franco finds support from Catholic opinion and right-wing opinion in Britain. But the Basque Children's Committee was caught in a dilemma because as time goes on, it wants to repatriate children, if possible, if safe. Not least because increasingly all these funds that are being raised for Spain in Britain, a lot of them are going to the Basque children because of their continued stay. And the National Joint Committee in particular is worried that it's not sending enough money for relief work in Spain itself. But the Basque Children's Committee also feels a deep and heartfelt responsibility for orphans. So children who have become orphaned or were orphaned. The children of parents who have been imprisoned, so particularly left-wing parents, if their parents were in prison, they didn't want to send them back to uncertainty. And many parents have become refugees themselves during the ongoing fighting in the Basque Country and had gone to France or elsewhere. So the majority of the Basque Children Committee members wanted to obtain assurances that the Basque Country was no longer a dangerous war zone, but also more difficult in some ways to establish where the parents were and what they wanted, what the wishes of the parents were. And this can be quite tricky because you'd think that a letter from a parent saying, come back, everything's fine. You'd think that would be a clear piece of evidence saying, it's fine to send these children back. But the Basque Children's Committee reported a meeting. The Basque Children's Committee met in July 1937, and one of the things they discussed was that one of the children at the Thaden Boy Colony outside London had received a letter from their father. But this letter had a small tear in the top left-hand corner, and that this was a prearranged signal that nothing in that letter should be trusted. And we see a lot of kind of examples of this where the parents have given the children codes to say, if the letter looks like this or has something about it or refers to a relative who's dead, but I'm talking about them as if they're alive, that this means do the opposite or do not trust this letter. So it becomes quite tricky for the Basque Children's Committee to fulfill its duty of care to these children and their parents' wishes. But repatriation really begins in earnest in November 1937, although by July 1938, around 2,000 of the children are still in Britain. The historian Peter Anderson, who's at Leeds, he's written on the repatriation controversy, a really interesting article on repatriation, and he says it kind of emerges as a transnational battlefield of the Spanish Civil War, both in Spain and in Britain. You have the children being used as propaganda symbols by both sides. Those in Britain who wanted to, Britain and Spain who wanted to kind of protect the children, arguing that to send them back to fascism would be terrible for them. Whereas the kind of Francoist opinion being, these children having their souls torn away from them by the leftists, it becomes nothing less than a battle for these children's souls. It's quite controversial. In my own research. The lady who runs the Ipswich colonies, a lady called Chloe Volumy, who's a kind of fascinating individual. She had a lot of sympathy for the Spanish Republic, had been in Spain before the Civil War and spoke Spanish. She resists attempts to send children back to what she called utter misery and starvation. She suggested to the Bass Children's Committee she'd be morally compelled to take whatever measures may be necessary to prevent the return of children from Ipswich unless she received adequate reassurances that they'd be safe. The Bass Children's Committee write back to her and say, you have every right to protest, but if you try and keep children here against the Bass Children's Committee's will, you'll have to resign. You can't be in charge of these children. She didn't quit, but she made the point that as a local organiser, she was in a much better position than the authorities in London to select children to go back to Spain for repatriation, because these local organisers were in direct daily contact with the young refugees. They could obtain the latest information regarding their parents' situation. Just to give you an example, this is a letter that she, this is from a letter she wrote in March 1938 about seven of the children who had been earmarked for repatriation. So she said, one of them, this girl's father, has been a prisoner for some time. Another, the mother is in Bilbao, but never speaks of the father. Another, last letter from father received last June. Another, these children receive letters, but parents constantly urge them to stay in England as long as possible and not to go back to Bilbao. Another, father is believed to be a prisoner. And another, has had no letter since December. So she's writing about her knowledge of these seven children and what their parents want, or whether their parents are even in contact or not. It's not clear if these complaints directly influenced the Bass Children's Committee, but out of these seven children, only two were repatriated immediately. Two went to Spain a year later. Another made the journey in 1940, and two stayed permanently in Britain. So repatriation was a really emotive and very difficult question, both for the Bass Children's Committee, the people who were looking after the children around the country, the children themselves, and of course their parents.
You mentioned a lot of concerns about repatriation in bad circumstances. Do we know if any of those concerns proved to be accurate?
Again, the experience of children who went back to Spain is varied. And again, you could tell a different story for every child who went back. The Basque Children's Committee received reports of children who had been returned only to end up on the streets without their families. Many who recalled their experience later in life recalled that they'd returned to difficult or terrible times under the Franco dictatorship. One recalled as they kind of went back into Spain, it was strange to suddenly hear Spanish spoken everywhere again. Another said that everyone who stayed in Britain was better off than if they'd gone back to Spain. So a lot of the material that I've seen suggests that it wasn't necessarily a great experience to go back to the Basque country. Of course, it was immediately post fighting. For many of them, it was quite traumatic to go back to a dictatorship, especially if their parents had been politically opposed to Franco. That could make things very difficult. Parents who've been imprisoned or lost their jobs as a result. But in other kind of memories I've read, sometimes the children say they went back to Spain and you know it was hard, but life went on, and they were back with their families and had families of their own as they entered adulthood. It's worth pointing out that some who remained in the UK in their later life or went elsewhere often reflected that while they were happy in the UK and while they'd had happy lives in the UK, they wondered what life could have been like if they'd have stayed in Spain, and often continued to miss their families. It was very difficult if they weren't repatriated. It was very difficult to see their families again, especially in the immediate aftermath of the Spanish Civil War. Often they wouldn't see their parents until the 50s or beyond, and those trips are quite interesting to read reports of how threatened these children who had kind of grown up in Britain in a democracy felt when they went to Franco Spain.
So you mentioned that there were still children left when an event occurs in 1939 that spools out into a war. So how many children were actually not repatriated before the war started, or were still in Britain maybe when the war ended?
Yeah, there was still a few hundred in Britain when the Second World War broke out. From late 1939 through until the fall of France in May 1940, you'd still find groups of children assembling at Victoria Station in London, at this point clutching gas masks, which the Bass Children's Committee had given to them for their return journey. So they're still kind of sent back across to France and then on to Spain up until May 1940. But what to do with those who weren't repatriated? Well, and what happened to them? The Bass Children's Committee started to think about the older boys and what they would do. They were kind of coming of age. In May 1939, they realised there were about 150 boys who were aged between 14 or 18 who were unlikely to be repatriated because of their parents' situations. And so they kind of cooperated with the trade union movement to establish the Basque Boys Training Committee. And this was designed to provide these children with an agricultural or industrial education so that they could be able to kind of support themselves, whether they became British citizens or whether they moved on. And there were certainly openings for a lot of these boys during the Second World War effort. A lot of older boys took jobs in things like engineering and agriculture and the building trade, and some signed up to serve in the RAF, the Navy, or the Home Guard. You know, that commitment to fight fascism still burned quite strongly in those who hadn't returned. There also remained a substantial number of younger children who were too young to work, who remained dependent on adult care and supervision. By June 1941, the Basque Children's Committee still had responsibility for 148 children under 14. And so there's still a handful of colonies operating in the Second World War, although they really struggled for funds in this period. So there were six colonies left in 1940, three by 1943, and only two by 1944. The colony at Carshalton was the last one and survived post-Second World War until it had finished looking after the last of the youngest children. Ultimately, around 250 of the 4,000 never went back to Franco Spain, or at least settled permanently outside. Many of them stayed in Britain. And as I said, some do make these poignant and dangerous visits back to Spain under the dictatorship, but they do choose to make their lives elsewhere. One of the Basque children I've been fortunate enough to meet, a man called Paco Robles, he's in his 90s now, and he was one of the children who came to Ipswich, and he came back to Ipswich a couple of years ago for the first time since the 1930s, because a plaque was unveiled at the site where he stayed, and he's remarkable. His memories are very interesting, but he said, I don't feel Spanish in Spain, I feel like a foreigner. In England too, I feel like a foreigner. As evacuees, we had our national identity taken away from us. It was stolen from us. So in a lot of the memories you see similar reflections about, you know, gratitude for the sanctuary provided in 1937, but also this sense of, you know, childhood being a very important formative experience, and missing out on family, missing out on education, but also this kind of broader sense of who are you, you know, in terms of national identity. So it's quite interesting.
So can you talk about the Basque Children Association, which is and what its kind of mission is, and what it's doing to help educate people about the experiences of these children?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, as you said, it was set up in 2002. It was set up by people who were connected to the experience of 1937. So Natalia Benjamin, who founded, who was one of the co-founders of the association, she was the daughter of teachers of the children, both a Spanish teacher, her mother, and an English teacher, her father. And her father actually lived and worked in Ipswich. So I feel like I'm living in this kind of centre of kind of Basque children activity in some ways here in Suffolk. So Natalia was very concerned that as the children got older, and unfortunately, of course, as they reach old age and die, their memory was being lost. And so, together with Manuel Moreno, who is the son of one of the children, they set up this association to kind of preserve collect and preserve materials. And so the Basque Children's Association has itself built up quite a large archive of testimony and other materials relevant to the Basque Children's story. And the association in recent years has formed quite a good link with the University of Southampton Archive Service, who hold the archive of the association, as well as other materials connected to the experience of the children. So it's quite nice that Southampton continues that connection with the children, and the association is involved in various events in Southampton. So yeah, the primary material, a primary aim was to gather primary material before it was lost. But over time, the association has developed into, it developed into a network for the surviving children and their families. So it holds kind of, or at least used to hold reunions for significant anniversaries where the children could meet and, talk about their experiences to kind of different audiences. It's increasingly been involved in commemoration activity. One of the things I mentioned that we were involved in an event to put a blue plaque up, not an official blue plaque, but something that looks like a blue plaque on the kind of Ipswich colony. In fact, we've now put one up on both of the colonies that operated near Ipswich. And throughout the country now, there are these plaques commemorating where the children stayed, which is quite nice, because people can walk past what look like very ordinary buildings sometimes and see, something remarkable happened here. There's one, for example, every time I go to Cambridge, I go on the train, I get off the train and you only have to walk a few steps and there's a building there where the children stayed, and there's a plaque on it there. So we do commemorative activity. We do educational work. So we talk to schools, local history groups, things like that. We run a very increasingly populated website, a website full of information, which can help to spark further research. Hopefully, we hope people will look at it and think, kind of, well, can I look into my local area more and contribute to this history? The website's well worth visiting. That's basquechildren.org. You can subscribe to our newsletter as well. Unfortunately, we haven't, of course, had many events this year, but hopefully when things return to normal, we'll be doing things all over the country again. We increasingly have links with the Basque country itself. We have a sister organisation now, the Basque Children Association, Euskadi, which spreads our work in the Basque country. And there's a lot of interest in the history of the Basque children there too. So yeah, we do a great deal. I've probably forgotten something, and I'll probably be told off by the other trustees for forgetting these things. But yeah, it's really good fun, and I think the it's a really important history. It's one of those histories where when you kind of first say it to an audience of people, often people say, "I never knew about that." They might know something about the Kinder Transport, but the Basque children, kind of, because I guess it was the beginning of this extremely busy period of history, and a busy period of history for child evacuees as well, because the Basque children are followed by the Kinder Transport. They're followed by wartime evacuees as well. Their history can become a little buried under all of this. So it's one of those kind of histories that's really nice to talk to people about, because it's something often that's quite new to them. And it's one that's still really relevant today. I mean, the question of child refugees hasn't gone away in Britain or anywhere else. So, it's got lessons, both good and bad, I think, for people to kind of draw upon this history.
Thank you for joining me here for this conversation about this topic. I will admit, I knew nothing about this before reaching out to you 2 months ago, I think, or a month and a half ago. So thank you.
No problem at all. Thank you.